Morning. Morning. It's good to be with you this morning. I appreciate the reading earlier from the book of Titus. That's going to be the centerpiece of our lesson this morning. This letter that Paul wrote to Titus it's not a lengthy letter, measured by verses. It's all of 46 verses. It's one of the shorter letters that we have of Paul's. And there's real beauty in its brevity. There is very little in the letter in way of introduction or valedictory. There's no long, multi-premised arguments like what he wrote in the letter to the Romans. He's not dealing with specific sins or false teachings like we find in his letters to Corinth or Thessalonica. This letter is brief and concise, and it feels as if it were written from a man to a person who he had a good relationship with. Someone who had spent a lot of time with Paul, who had a grasp and understanding of what Paul had taught in the name of Christ. And this makes sense when we look at the history of Paul's relationship with Titus. We know Titus had traveled with Paul. They had been through quite a bit together, actually. We find that Titus was a man of Greek ethnicity. And the Christian Jews had pressured him to be circumcised. Paul writes about this in Galatians chapter 2. This was part of the old law that Christian Jews tried to push off onto Christians. And Paul had stood beside Titus in resisting this call to do this. We also know that Titus was the one who took the letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. He's the one that delivered that to the congregation in Corinth. The first one we know was delivered by Titus, and the second one appears that it was also delivered by Titus as well. And these letters were not light in their content. Paul was dealing with some very difficult issues in those letters that he wrote to the church of Corinth. The church was very dysfunctional. They were divided amongst one another, having aligned themselves under the Christians who had baptized them. Their use of spiritual gifts was done with apparent envy and competition with one another. They had blatant sexual immorality among their members, and they weren't participating in the Lord's Supper together. And so these were all issues that Paul wrote about and addressed in the book of Corinth, and those weren't even all the issues that he addressed in that letter to the church. The church at that time was dysfunctional in many ways, and it was disorderly. And I would imagine, and this is somewhat speculative, but I would imagine the person that Paul would send to deliver that letter would be a man capable of not just handing them the letter, but also in helping them process it. And I think Paul's second letter to the Corinthians indicates that Titus was more than a simple letter deliverer. He mentions there in that letter that the congregation received Titus with fear and trembling. So I don't think Titus was there just to deliver a letter. He was there to administer a message. Now, this letter here, drawing our attention back to the letter to Titus, it's believed that this letter was written to Titus later in Paul's life, after those letters to the church in Corinth. So when Titus had received this letter, he had seen the necessary pieces for a functional congregation. He had seen and helped an apostle take a congregation from chaos, where there was sin and disunity, to order, where there was penitence and love. And that's important context to this letter, because Paul's letter to Titus centers around the task of going to various congregations in Crete and setting in order the things that are lacking. He instructs him to do this here in verse 5 of chapter 1. So when Paul wrote this letter to Titus, Titus knew the goal. He knew what the church was to look like. He knew what it meant to set a church in order. To set something in order is a process. It's a process with a purpose, a process to organize a group of complementary things together to work towards a purpose. Our God creates order. He sets things in order to work towards a purpose. We literally see that from the very beginning. Genesis chapter 1 tells us that in the beginning the earth was without form. God would give it form after creating light and dividing it from the darkness. He divided the waters, and he created the heaven and the waters of the earth and set one above the other. He divided the day and the night. He created a hierarchy when he placed man over all created beings. He created and set the creation in order so that it would work. And that's what we see around us, right? God's creation works. It functions to support life and propagate until the time of Christ's return. Another of God's great creations, the old law that he gave to the Jews, had a similar story. The purpose of any law is to set things in order. God's law was established so that the Jews would have something to govern them, to keep them together as a nation, to give them a hierarchy of authority with himself at the head, to maintain their health and sanitation, to help them focus their lives on serving him. The law brought order so that their society would work together towards growth and spiritual prosperity. And if we bring this concept to our own lives, this concept of setting things in order, I think we would all find that we've done things to set something in order. It may be our home. It could be our finances, managing a project in our occupation or running a business. It may be at a team in sports or school activity. When you went about setting those things in order, you went through a process so that those things would work to the intended purpose. You set your home in order so that it was easier to live in. You set your finances in order so that you have money to pay bills, to tithe, and hopefully have some to put aside for financial security. You set your project or your people that you manage in order to accomplish the goals of the project. You set your team in order so that you can win or perform at an excellent level. So as Titus would go through the work that he had been left by Paul to do, to set things in order, the purpose behind this was to put things in place so that these congregations could work towards their intended purpose. And one of the beautiful things about this letter is that it provides us with a concise description of what Paul, and more importantly, God, sees as necessary for things to be set in order in a congregation. Some of the things that he talks about is having leadership in place, dealing with false and distracting teachers, the characteristics of the various demographics within a congregation, that what they should be aspiring to, appropriate behavior towards non-believers, avoiding divisive people, and there's a lot of other things that we could list that he brings out in this letter. Now, I think it's an interesting thought experiment to ask a question, or to ask the question. If Titus were to come to a congregation that we ourselves were a part of to set things in order, according to this letter, what would be the kind of things that he would focus on? What would be the kind of things he would talk about? Are they administrative and organizational? Well, some. Given the first part of the chapter, he would look to establish leadership. And I'm sure if there were issues like what he had managed in Corinth with their assemblies, he'd walk through those things as well. But according to this letter, what kind of things would he be looking to affirm constantly, as Paul told him to do in chapter 3? Now, I'm sure there's several ways that you could summarize this, or I know there's several ways that this could be summarized. But the way I'll put it is there's three things that we're going to talk about this morning, or I'm going to talk about this morning, that he focused on. Good teaching, good character, and good works. For things to be set in order, for a congregation to be able to work to its given purpose, the people within those congregations will be doing and pursuing those things. And that's more of what this letter is about. He writes about maintaining truthful and profitable teaching, and a lot about the manner of life that the members, that the Christians that were part of these congregations should live. Your elders, talks about those. Here's what they should look like. Your older men, this is what they're to look like. The older women, these are characteristics that you should have. Younger women, here is where you is who you should be. Younger men, here's a pattern of good works for you to follow. Those are all things that we find in this letter. Even bondservants, here is what relationship you should have with your master. And then he ties it all together there in chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. And he says, "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age." That's verses 11 and 12 of chapter 2. So I think this letter draws a direct line to every one of us to have a responsibility, and that we have a responsibility in setting the things in order in whatever congregation we're a part of. For our groups to be set in order, for our group to work to its intended purpose, these are things that each of us, individually and collectively, need to be working towards. That's what this letter is telling us. It's not just about the elders, the leadership. It's not just about the organization and the structure. It's just not about doing the correct things when we come here. Now, those are absolutely 100% critical, but they alone won't make a congregation work. They're not only what Titus would go into as he traveled to each congregation. Now, his message would be directly, much of his message would be directly to the people within those congregations, to teach what is true and profitable, to take on these characteristics, to look to perform good works. A congregation whose people do that will be set in order. And we see the importance in this and Paul's instructions on how Titus was to teach this to the congregations. In chapter 3 and verse 8, Is it verse 8 or verse 9? It is verse 8. In Titus 3 and verse 8, it says, "This is a faithful saying, and these things I want to affirm, these things I want you to affirm constantly, that those who have believed in God should be careful to maintain good works. These things are good and profitable to men." So Paul here is telling him to affirm these things constantly. And when he says these things, I don't think he's just talking about the verses just right around there. I think he's talking about the whole letter. And he says that these things should be affirmed constantly. And the Greek behind that phrase means to affirm strongly. And I like actually how the ESV translates that phrase there. If you're looking at the ESV, it says to insist on these things. He wanted people to understand how important it was. Because it's not easy work. It requires all of us to be mindful of the tasks and be resilient in carrying them through. So let's just take what time we have remaining here and consider these things. Good teaching, good character, and good works. The church has a responsibility. Each congregation has a responsibility to teach and uphold the truth. We can't grow closer to God. We can't worship Him. And we can't root out sin in our lives if we don't have a proper understanding of who God is, how He wants us to worship, and who He wants us to be. And without a commitment to truth, false teaching will enter into the church, and the intended purpose and the functioning of a congregation will break down. The world has a way of breaching these walls, and fleshly motives have a way of corrupting our thinking. And we can see from the New Testament just how easily this can happen, as so many of the letters we have written either deal with false teaching or warn of it. It's all throughout the New Testament. The fact that God even designated an office, the eldership, that has the direct responsibility of dealing with false teaching is also a testament to the prevalence of the danger. And those warnings are certainly front and center in this letter. In verses 10 through 16 of chapter 1, Paul warns of insubordinate idol talkers and deceivers pulling people from the truth, right? So he's talking about false teachers there. But there's also, though, another characterization of teaching that Paul warns of here and also in a few other passages that I want to shift our attention to this morning. And we see this warning in chapter 3 and verse 9 where he calls out some other types of teaching that were occurring and should be avoided. So this is chapter 3 and verse 9. It reads, "But avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and useless." Now the way Paul characterizes these things doesn't sound like untruthful teaching. What he seems to be more concerned about here is the usefulness of them. The usefulness of the things that are being taught within the congregations. And he says, they're not profitable to the congregations. They cause strife, they increase divisiveness, and they have no use. Paul writes of something similar if we go over to 1 Timothy chapter 1. It's another letter written to another evangelist like Titus. 1 Timothy chapter 1, looking at verses 3 and 4. Verse 3 reads, "As I urged you, when I went into Macedonia, remain in Ephesus that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine." Now this verse, it is clear that he's talking about false teaching. He references other doctrines here. In verse 4, though, he switches gears slightly and he says, Nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies which cause disputes rather than godly edification which is in faith. Now again, this doesn't seem like a matter of what is true, but of what is beneficial. He doesn't call these things false or evil or wrong, but what he does say is they don't accomplish the purpose of the teaching, which is godly edification. It's godly edification. One last passage I'll reference along these lines is over in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. And this is a passage where we don't see a condemnation to any specific false teaching, but more a look or an examination of the usefulness of what is being done within the assembly. This chapter is largely about the assembly, and one of the things that Paul is doing in this chapter is helping the brethren in Corinth understand the proper use of spiritual gifts. Now, we don't necessarily have those like they had here, speaking in tongues and prophesying, but there's still a lot that we can take away from this passage. And one message that I think is really important is that the things that we say and the things that we do need to have a purpose. They need to be useful. And where I get this from is in Paul's contextualizing of the gifts of speaking in tongues. Now, it seems, if you read into this passage sums, it seems that maybe people have placed a greater importance on this gift of speaking in tongues. And it's likely because it was a very showy gift, right? It was something that had a... It was unique. It was a showy gift. But the point that Paul is making is that if you're speaking in tongues, right, and there's no one there to interpret what it is that you're saying, then no one receives edification because they don't know what you're saying. There's nothing that they're receiving. There's no teaching that you're receiving. In verses 18 and 19 of this chapter, Paul wrote this: "I thank my God I speak with tongues more than you all. Yet in the church, I would rather speak five words with my understanding that I may teach others also than 10,000 words in a tongue." This is probably one of Paul's lines that I think comes the closest to sarcasm here. I would rather speak five words with my understanding that I may teach others also than 10,000 words in a tongue. And the point is that the five words, other people will understand. They'll be able to learn from it, whereas with the tongues, they won't. Later on in the chapter, he tells them that if one of them has an utterance with the tongue, and there's not somebody there to interpret what's being said, what are they to do? Just keep silent. That's right. Just keep silent. There's no point in you saying this, because no one is going to gain anything from it. So why even take the time? So this is something for us to consider and remember. Something for us as teachers to consider and remember, that our goal when we teach should be something that is profitable. And as obvious as that might be, the application of it can be difficult, and maintaining the focus on that can be hard. Speaking for myself, an honest self-reflection of all the times that I have taught and prepared for lessons would reveal that hasn't always been my primary goal. Now, it wasn't that I was thinking, hey, I'm going to throw something useless out here. But maybe my focus wasn't on doing my best to make it profitable. Sometimes I was far more concerned with filling the time than filling the content. And there have been sermons and classes where I gave less time or less thought to than it deserves. And that's certainly not me being concerned about it being profitable. Now, to be clear, though, for something to be profitable, it does not have to be profound. Now, if you have something deeply insightful to share, please do, but it's not necessary. We don't have to worry about coming up with some amazing piece of wisdom. I mean, just look at what the kind of things that Paul told Titus to teach. So much of what we have here needs to be, or what he does there and what we need to do here, is acts of reminders, right, of how to live, because living for God is hard. And we've taken up Christ's cross. The burden is light, as he tells us, but the path is narrow. And we teach because we love each other, we love our congregations, and we want to share something to help them in their struggle to serve the Lord. Right? We're not looking to push agendas. We're not looking to just fill time. We're not trying to help or look, or we're not trying to impress or look good. We're just trying to help one another. And we all play a part in this, even if we're not the teachers, or even if we're not the ones at the podium on a given Sunday. You know, I've often wondered where I would be at in my Christian walk if I would have paid close attention to all the sermons in the classes that I had sat through. You know, there have been times in my life where I sat in my pew less attentive than others. Now, some of those had to do with stages of life. You know, when you've got little kids crawling on you in the middle of a service, it's really hard to focus. Right? You come in and out of paying attention all the time in that. It's hard to concentrate there. But I'm talking about those times when my mind has just been elsewhere. I'm here, but I'm not here. I'm here, but my mind is somewhere else. And how many thoughtful points from my brethren have I missed? How many reminders that I could have used have gone over my head? And how many words that may have inspired, that are words from the inspired scripture, have I missed that would have convinced me to make some change in my life? And probably more than a few. Another item that we see Paul focus on in this letter as he's instructing Titus to set things in order is the character of the members of the congregation. There are several lists of Christian characters or Christian virtues in this letter, and most of them were specifically directed to an office like the eldership and to certain demographics. You know, he writes specifically to older men, older women, young men, young women, and bondservants. And each of us can find a place in there, in one of those groups. Even in the case of bondservants, right? We can make a lot of application to that in regards to maybe our occupation. Now, I won't go through these qualities one by one. We certainly don't have the time, but just a couple general comments, though. That there is a lifetime of work found in these verses. When we read these verses, there is absolutely a lifetime of work found in there. There is much depth that they are not qualities that are easily obtained. And once obtained, it's not a guarantee that we'll continue in them or have a perfect application of each one of them at all times. There's much depth to be found in concepts such as being sober-minded and being temperate, reverent, or discreet, just to name a few of the things that Paul brings out there. And if we find ourselves thinking that we've mastered such things or fully explored their depths, I think an honest, humble reflection will reveal broader and deeper levels of application of these things in our lives. But working on them and developing them requires commitment and consistency. And Paul brings this out in a lot of the other letters he wrote. One case, in one instance, in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 7 and 8, Paul tells Timothy to exercise himself towards godliness, and he compares the universal utility of godly exercise to the more limited application of physical exercise. The metaphor, though, also paints a picture of what exercising towards godliness entails. You know, physical exercise is of benefit when it's consistently applied, and progress in that isn't seen in leaps and bounds, but rather gradually over time as the cumulative effect of consistently and repetitively challenging the body builds resiliency and strength. And so goes it with godly gain. We cannot expect to possess or grow in qualities like sober-mindedness or temperance or reverence if we don't devote ourselves to those things. We can't expect to have those without devotion to them any more than we could expect to run 10 miles at an 8-mile-an-hour pace without having laced up running shoes in 2 years. Right? If you want to run the long miles, you have to do the work. And I think that's what Paul is telling Titus, or I think that's why he's telling Titus here to insist on these things, because they're not done. They're not a part of our lives. They're not part of who we are without commitment and consistency. We don't possess them to the extent that we could or should if we don't work towards them. Now, one thing that I found interesting, or that I find interesting about chapter 2, where many of these lists are contained, is that the word doctrine is used three different times in that passage, in three different verses. We see it in verse 1, verse 7, and verse 10. And in verse 10, he writes of bondservants adorning the doctrine of God as if it's something that's worn, not just taught. Now, a lot of times when we think of the term doctrine, we oftentimes, or most oftentimes, associate it with subject matters, right? And that's a correct way to look at it. That's the application we find consistently throughout the Bible. Right? The teachings of Christ are referred to as doctrines. We find that the early church followed the doctrine of the apostles, the teaching of the apostles. The scriptures also talk about false doctrines, doctrines of demons. And when we talk about these things, when we talk about doctrine, we tend to look at them as non-negotiable items, correct? The doctrinal matters are truth. They are teachings that cannot be deviated from. And in fact, at times when I hear Christians discussing the idea about Christian liberty, the point is often made that lines should be firmly drawn on doctrinal matters, right? We don't need to give on these doctrinal matters. Now, all those applications are correct, right? I'm not arguing otherwise. But it struck me to see the term doctrine used here as it is in Titus chapter 2 because it broadens the term to apply not just to subject matters, but also in the way that we act and behave. Christian behavior is doctrine. And that makes perfect sense because it is the teaching of Christ. But thinking about it this way does seem to place a greater emphasis on these things. They're non-negotiable. These are qualities we must all pursue and we must work to possess. The last thing I'll note before we wrap up this morning is Paul's instruction that the brethren should maintain good works. The first time we see him mention good works is in chapter 1 and verse 16 when writing about the false teachers who profess to know God, but in works deny him. Now, this is obviously a camp that we don't want to be in. We're professing to know God, but in our day-to-day activities, we don't do the things that a godly person should be doing. In contrast, what we want to strive for is what Paul writes in verse 14. Verses 11 through 14 of Titus, this is in chapter 2, is one really long sentence. And at the end, in verse 14, he's writing about what Jesus did for us, how he gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people zealous for good works. So we see here part of the intent behind Christ's sacrifice was to create a people who wanted to do good works. He wants people working in the kingdom. And Paul draws this out three or four times in chapter 3. In verse 1, he wants everyone to be ready for good works. In verse 8, he says that we should be careful to maintain good works. And in his parting words, in verse 14, he says, "And let our people also learn to maintain good works to meet urgent needs, that they may not be untruthful." Now, that's a lot about works there packed into 20 verses or so. He brings it up four separate times. And within those verses, we see what our attitude towards works should be. We see that we should have a zeal for them, meaning that there should be a desire to do good works, a desire to find good things to do within God's kingdom. This is something that we should try to instill a level of excitement for, looking to do these things, looking to serve one another. There's also a level of preparation in performing good works. We have to work on ourselves to make sure that we're ready for good works. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 21 talks about something similar to this, where he talks about cleansing ourselves so that we're sanctified for good works. 2 Timothy chapter 3 verses 16 and 17, we see that the word takes a place in this preparation process. Right? So we need to be spending time removing sin and spending time in the word to prepare ourselves to do the work within God's kingdom. And one way I think about this is going back and thinking about passages like 1 Corinthians chapter 13 that talks about love and what love looks like and how we change and mold and shape, try to shape ourselves so that we're doing and we take on the characteristics of love that are found there so that we can be of better service to one another. We put ourselves in a position to be able to see the needs of others and being more willing to help. And in being careful to maintain good works, that's what he says there also, be careful to maintain good works. It's something that we're to be thoughtful about. The Greek word behind the word careful means to think, to be thoughtful or anxious. There's a level of anxiety that's also in that word too. So it's something that we're actively looking to do. It's on our mind. And in maintaining them, we're continuing in them. And there's a lot of different forms that this could take, and we could spend a lot of time talking about what good works looks like. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10 writes of us being willing to share with the blessings that we have. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 24 and 25 writes about the need for a commitment to the assembly so that we can be here to stir up love and good works, exhorting one another. We can go to scriptures like in Galatians chapter 5. Where we have the fruits of the Spirit are listed there, and they're listed there in contrast to the works of the flesh, which means I think we can take that the fruits of the Spirit are also the work of the Spirit, which is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, and self-control. And we can spend a lot of time talking about what that means, but I think we all have a concept of what good works entails. It's exhibiting godly behavior and taking action to further His kingdom to those who are outside, right? To help one another in their troubles. And acts of assistance or encouragement towards our brothers and sisters who are trying to walk the same path that we are. And in looking at this letter to Titus, I think we should all be taking an account of what we're doing and see what else we can do to this end. And if we're prepared, if we're thoughtful, and if we're continuing in good works. So set in order the things that are lacking. You know, when I was recently reading this letter, and I read this statement the umpteenth time, however many times I read the statement, but I read that and then noticed that most of the letter was about the people within the congregation, right? How their teaching, their conduct, their works. It made me feel a new sense of responsibility. Titus was put to the task to put things in order in these congregations, to make congregations work so that they can fulfill a purpose. And it appears that much of his efforts in doing this would be centered around the people, because that's what makes this work. Right? We come here to learn, to be encouraged, to be spiritually fed, to grow in Christ, to inspire one another to change, to worship God with others. And for that to work, for that purpose to be fulfilled, we need profitable teaching. We need to have good character. And we need to be looking to do good works. And that comes down to each of us. And without that, without those things, this congregation won't work the way that God wants it to. I'll leave that lesson with you. At this time, we're going to offer the gospel invitation. Here in just a moment, we're going to stand and sing an invitation song. And this is a time that if there is anything that the congregation can do for you, if there's a request that you would like to make for help or assistance or prayers, this is a good time for that. But it's also a time that if you have not accepted Jesus Christ as your Savior and you would like to do so and be baptized for the remission of your sins, we invite you to come forward as we stand and we sing.